Kelsey Obeywe lives in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He grew up in the Pentecostal church. His family went to service every Sunday. The church was his rock.
It gave me a strong sense of community. I made a lot of friends and had a lot of mentors too, you know, and that's probably one of the things that's something that I can definitely appreciate, because I can name at least three or four mentors off the top of my head that definitely helped shape and mold the person I am today.
Kelsey became a mentor in his church himself, leading Bible studies and Sunday school classes. But then came 2013 and the Black Lives Matter movement, which resonated deeply with Kelsey. But he stopped feeling that same resonance in the messages he was hearing in church.
I would see a lot of people say things that, you know, just were off-putting to me, whether it be, you know, these guys deserve to die because they were criminals, or whether it was a very nonchalant approach to how I was feeling about the whole situation, or even just colorblind ideas, you know, telling me that I shouldn't be concerned about my blackness. I should be more concerned about being a child of God. And I just didn't know how to wrestle with that.
Kelsey says his commitment to the Pentecostal community and to mentoring young people kept him at the church for a while. But 4 years later, he walked away.
I think by that time, I had just already been burnt out completely, to the point where I just no longer wanted anything to do with the faith community at all.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Kelsey Obeywe is now a sophomore at Montgomery College in Maryland. And even though he left his church, the need for community, mentorship, and moral grounding did not leave him. So where did he turn to find that? He turned, in part, to activism.
Political communities can, at times, mirror religious communities.
Kelsey's story of leaving the church has now become a majority tale in America. A recent Gallup poll found that less than half of Americans now belong to a house of worship, making it the first time membership in formal houses of worship went below 50%, the first time since Gallup began measuring this in 1937. So where are people turning to instead? Here's what we want to find out today. Could political movements be a new religion in America? Well, we're going to start today with Casper Turkile. He's co-founder of Sacred Design Lab and Ministry Innovation Fellow at Harvard Divinity School. He co-authored How We Gather and Care of Souls, two reports profiling new forms of social and spiritual connection. Casper Turkile, welcome to On Point.
Great to be with you, Meghna.
So first of all, let's talk about the specific finding of this Gallup poll. Were you surprised that they found that membership in houses of worship in the United States now, insofar as Americans reporting that membership, has dipped below 50% for the first time?
It's not a surprise. It's really the latest kind of data point in a longer standing story that more and more Americans are just less and less religious. But that's just part of the story. And I think Kelsey's story is so interesting because it illustrates something much more prevalent, but perhaps less understood, which is that as people are leaving these kind of formal institutions, right, they're no longer members of a congregation. It doesn't mean that their spirituality no longer exists, right? They're still looking for community. They're still looking for mentorship and intergenerational connection. And for most of them, they still believe in God or a higher power. You know, we have other data that illustrates that for people who are not members of a religious institution, 2 out of 3 of them still believe in God or a higher power. And 1 in 5 even pray every day. So it's less a story about decline, at least for people's own spirituality, and really more a story of transformation.
Interesting. So that's an important distinction to make here, because just to reiterate, Gallup was asking about membership, formal membership in houses of worship, right? They weren't
that's
asking
right.
about sense of spirituality. But regarding the, I mean, this is an issue about we're focusing on the organized religion mm-hmm. part of it, right? And it seems it's so fascinating to me that Gallup has been measuring this since 1937, as I mentioned. And at that first poll they did, again, it was in the 30s, but reported religious membership was at 73%. And it stayed roughly at that number, roughly 70%, for the next 60 years.
That's right.
The decline that we're seeing really only began and then accelerated after the turn of the millennium, right? After 2001, it was by 2018, it was down from 50%, and now we have it at 47%, as reported
That's
by
right.
Gallup. What do you think is happening or has happened in the past 20 years?
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? You have this really consistent kind of number being held throughout the 20th century. And, you know, if in the American imagination, there's this kind of high point in the 1950s where everyone's, you know, in church on a Sunday morning. But now that story looks really, really different. And there are a number of factors. You know, one of them is down to the fact that the workforce has changed. So many of those congregations were kept running at the scale in which they were running because of the free labor of women, for example. So there's some economic drivers. I think the main point, or at least one of the two, perhaps, is the arrival of the internet. Because it's not just a question that people are now finding, you know, worship experiences online, or they're connecting with a community on a Reddit thread, or, you know, all the ways in which during the pandemic, we've seen people find new ways to participate in religious communities. But it's really changed, especially generationally, the way in which younger people expect authority to be shared. So rather than looking at a central institution or a particular ordained leader who has a message to give and has the authority to do so, I think what the internet has done is shifted us to look at crowds, to look for networks. You know, we're more likely to trust the upvoted review on an Amazon product, for example, than we are an expert's opinion. And so when you're a centralized institution trying to share, you know, whether it's the word of God or religious community, there's a real cultural mismatch between how they are built to serve people and how more and more, especially young people, want to find community meaning and purpose.
Uh-huh. Well, we have this comment that's come in on social media, apropos. Ryan Castle says, I left Christianity years ago when I realized all of the things I liked about it, community, altruism, philosophy, could be found in secular groups and nonprofits. So do we know more about where people are turning to if the traditional house of worship is no longer the sole place that provides them those things, community, altruism, and philosophy that they had that people are still looking for?
That's right. And this has really been the core of my work with my team at Secret Design Lab, where we've looked at the ostensibly secular places that people are going to do very, very religious things. So, for example, we spent a lot of time looking at justice groups, at creative groups, you know, people who get together to make jewelry, for example, in a maker space, or people who get together to work out in a fitness class together. And it's not just that they're doing those activities together. There's sort of a social layer that builds around it. So people are getting together for drinks on a Friday night, or they're hosting their, you know, 4th of July barbecue together. And then suddenly you start seeing that they're asking their fitness instructor to officiate their wedding, or they're going to their makerspace because they have, you know, their mother has passed away or has been diagnosed with cancer, and they're looking for that kind of pastoral support. And so you're seeing in these secular places, people really looking for those deeper experiences of community and meaning making. The final place that we've seen a really large growth in terms of where people are turning is the workplace. So especially younger people are showing up at work wanting to find a community of belonging, wanting to find meaning and purpose in their work, and those intergenerational relationships of mentorship and guidance that go way beyond just how can I improve, you know, at my job, to really being to looking for guidance on bigger life questions.
That is absolutely fascinating. But couldn't seeking that kind of moral grounding or value-based community in secular spaces be a little troublesome because
Absolutely.
Values clash, do they not?
Yeah, I mean, how can you be in relationship of community with someone who can fire you? You know, these are real ethical challenges. And unfortunately, you know, the same challenges that arise in congregations arise in fitness community or creativity groups or, frankly, justice movements. So relationships that go wrong, financial mismanagement, bullying and exclusion, right? All of those same things, unfortunately, happen in these secular spaces. And more often than not, those leaders are not equipped in the way that you might be if you're an ordained rabbi or priest or imam with some of the skills to navigate a situation like that. And so there's a real challenge, I think, that you know, more and more people are going to these secular places to find essentially spiritual well-being. But those leaders and those new places haven't been resourced in a way to really hold and receive those longings skillfully.
So the place we're going to really focus on is politics for the remainder of this hour, because it does seem as if there is a marked rise in ideological intensity in American politics across the spectrum over the past generation, let's put it that way. I mean, do you think there is something to people turning to politics to channel what was previously a religious fervor?
I mean, certainly, it's been said before that politics is religion without transcendence. So a lot of the markers of religiosity, you can absolutely see in political movements, right? That sense of identity, the sense of belonging, the sense of moral clarity, even some of the rituals, right, in which communities form and behave together to strengthen those identities, that absolutely makes sense. I guess one thing to say is just that we shouldn't draw a really clear, line between religion and politics. If you look back at the 90s, this was really a moment, it was remembered as the nasty 90s, when conservative Christian groups especially became really actively involved in political questions. And so that's part of why I think we've seen this movement away from institutional religion, because people looked at these religious groups and saw them as kind of tainting themselves in questions of politics.
Well, Casper Turkile, co-founder of Sacred Design Lab at the Harvard Divinity School, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're asking the question of whether politics is a new religion in America. And the question was triggered by a very interesting Gallup poll that recently came out that found for the first time since Gallup has started measuring this, beginning in 1937, for the first time, fewer than 50% of Americans now say they belong to a formal house of worship. Now, at the start of this hour, we heard from Kelsey Obeywe. And he told us about the reason that he had left his Pentecostal church and that now he's doing things in terms of his activism that connects his previous experience of community that he had in the church now with social justice. So we asked him, does he think that some of that energy and passion, in fact, did come from the church and has been translated into his activism?
For me, evangelizing for the church and preaching a message and the passion that I had for it definitely carried over into the passion that I have for justice. In some ways, I even learned that passion from the church and from my readings of scripture and carried it over into the political realm and activist realm, in all honesty. Yeah.
That's Kelsey Obeywe. He's a sophomore at Montgomery College who writes about his experiences with religion and spirituality and on social justice issues as well. Well, joining us now is Shadi Hamid. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, contributing writer for The Atlantic. He recently wrote an article in The Atlantic titled America Without God. Shadi Hamid, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, you heard Casper Terkile just before the break issue a word of caution that it's not that religion hasn't basically frequently been a part of American politics. And point taken, I mean, I'm going to talk in a few minutes or ask you in a few minutes about how long religion itself has been at the center of American politics. So I want to just be clear about my language. I'm curious about religiosity or religious fervor in how Americans view and practice their politics now. Have you seen a marked rise in that religiosity, Shadi?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, it's not just a decline in church membership that we've seen. According to the same Gallup poll, the percentage of Americans who say that religion is either extremely important or very important in their daily lives has also gone below 50% for the first time. And we might be able to debate what's meant by religion, but mm-hmm. clearly it's not just an issue of being a member in a particular church or house of worship. And that's what leads to this, I think, broader observation that if traditional religion is going down and more Americans are moving away from that, something has to fill the gap. Now, it's just really a question of what fills the gap. And I think what we've seen in recent years, and if we want to contrast this, say, with the Obama era, where the debates were, let's say, a little bit more pedestrian. I mean, healthcare policy, important, but not existential. Also, you know, there were controversies over Obama wearing a tan suit. What we see really intensifying in the Trump era is that the divides in the U.S. are becoming foundational. They're about really the most personal things that you can think of, what it means to be an American, how to understand the founding. And that divide is a very stark one. And we're also seeing a pretty precipitous drop in perceptions of national pride. And there's also some interesting Gallup numbers there, too, that we can talk about. So, you know, what I would say is filling the gap are, you know, there are things on the left, and people can debate how to describe this. I mean, wokeness or wokeism, which is, you know, sometimes a pejorative term, but taking what are legitimate racial justice issues that most Americans agree with or sympathize with to one degree or another, but going in this more excessive direction where there's a desire to punish and render judgment anyone who has the wrong ideas on what are still issues that reasonable people can disagree on. I mean, what to do about policing? We can agree that there is a police abuse problem in this country, but then the question is what to do about it. But those issues are now becoming very intense with this new, let's say, woke movement in the U.S. that has gained steam on the left side of the spectrum. On the right, in my Atlantic article, I talk about how traditional Christianity has increasingly become subsumed under the Trump-centric mm-hmm. Republican Party and under Christian nationalism, where the focus isn't the Son of God. The focus is blood and soil, let's say. It's this more base nationalism. And Trump himself is not obviously a Christian character, but he is someone who was supported by an overwhelming majority of evangelicals. So, I mean, that has been a puzzle that people have been struggling right. with.
Well, Shadi, hang on here for a second, because we actually have some tape that illustrates exactly the sort of two poles that you're talking about. So first of all, regarding the almost messianic view that some Trump supporters have of him, whether or not they actually formally belong to a church right now. I mean, here's an example. This is former Energy Secretary Rick Perry in 2019 on Fox talking about a conversation he had with Donald Trump where Perry was telling a story he told Trump about the flawed figures of the Bible.
And I shared it with him. I said, Mr. President, I know there are people that say, you know, you said you were the chosen one. And I said, you were.
So there's sort of a messianic view of who Donald Trump is or what he represents to some people. And then there's also this example from you were talking about, quote unquote, wokeness. And I feel like in some of the language of people who practice, quote unquote, wokeness, there's a sense that there's an inescapable original sin, a new kind of original sin, and that is having white skin. I mean, here's an example of Robin DiAngelo, author of the best-selling book White Fragility. She was on late night TV with Jimmy Fallon, and she was sharing a story with Jimmy Fallon about how she thinks it's impossible. She believes it's literally impossible for white people, no matter who they are, no matter what they say, to not be defensive in conversations about race.
I just want all the white people to just take that in, our inevitable racist assumptions and behaviors. That's how difficult we are.
So kind of original sin there from Robin DiAngelo. Now, Shadi Hamid, you wrote in your Atlantic piece that political debates over what America is supposed to mean have taken on the character of theological disputations. This is what religion without religion looks like. Tell me more about what you mean.
Yeah, well, so, you know, first of all, there has been something that has united up until recently most Americans, and that is this kind of this civic faith in the American idea, which is open to not just Christians, but people of all faiths. And I'm a child of immigrants. I'm Muslim. And my parents were able to become American in a way they wouldn't be able to in, say, Germany or Sweden, where, you know, Germany is the land of Germans. It's an accident of birth. It's not an ideological project. So that's what makes the American idea distinctive. Now, the issue here today is that if you keep on attacking the founding and saying that it's all bad, that and obviously part of it is evil. I mean, the original sin of slavery, and that's something that everyone has to acknowledge in a very serious way. Mm-hmm. But once you start taking that again several steps further to say that Americans should be ashamed of who they are, and especially white Americans should be ashamed of who they are, then you lose this uniting American faith. And then what else do you have to fall back on? If you're losing Christianity and if you're losing a common sense of being American, then there's not a whole lot left to work with. And the Gallup poll on national pride, the numbers are actually incredible, that the percentage of Democrats who say that they're extremely proud to be American was 65% in 2003. In 2020, it dropped down to 24%. I couldn't even believe these numbers when I first saw them. So that's about a 40% drop, and it's not an accident that it's happened in recent years during the Trump era, where I think the fact that we elected Donald Trump made many Democrats feel differently about their country in a fundamental way. And also the language that I think we see from some mainstream elite institutions about all white people are bad, everything about America is bad, or most of what America is about is bad. That is undermining something that's very important. So that's where my concern really comes in here.
Well, so, but don't we also simultaneously have the now more open truth that for so many Americans, people of color, for virtually the entire history of this country, that sense of belonging to that the civic religion of Americanness has never been fully granted to them. I mean, we had a conversation a couple of days ago where we had comments coming in on social media of people saying, well, I have always, you know, felt oppressed by virtue of the color of my skin, by, you know, racist institutions, so that, of course, I don't feel fully American. It's just I'm able to talk about it more now.
Yeah, so I think there's definitely part of that that is true. I guess the question is, if we want racial justice in this country, does it have to come with some of these more excessive manifestations of say, someone like Robin DiAngelo? Do the two have to go together? And I worry that when we focus on the performative aspect of this, where white people are encouraged to check their privilege and atone for their sins in this very kind of performative and public way, it actually distracts from systemic issues like reforming sentencing guidelines or criminal justice reform, or actually changing things that affect people on a daily basis. It's this kind of, it's an elite preoccupation, and it centers the conversation around white people. If it's white people who have to look inside of themselves and find the truth, that is not, to me, what the key issue facing our country is. So I think we have to separate between the systemic and the personal and the performative.
Okay, point taken. But in terms of how, again, to use the language from your very interesting piece in The Atlantic about that political conversation or political debates in this country, I love how you write, they have taken on the character of theological disputations, meaning that no matter where you are in the political spectrum, it seems as if people lead with what are uncompromisable values, right? And we're seeing clearly and have been seeing the same thing for a long time on the right as well. That cannot be healthy for the United States, which is still ostensibly a secular democracy, to have uncompromisable religiosity or value-based fervor be the means by which we are supposed to be talking to each other from wherever we are on the political spectrum, it seems an impossibility.
I mean, you're exactly right, because if you do see things in this kind of values-based way where your fellow Americans are no longer just people you disagree with, which is fine. We're supposed to disagree with each other. That's part of democracy. But you actually see them as enemies to be defeated. Those high stakes are dangerous for a democracy, because what it means is that every election becomes almost quite literally a matter of life and death. And there can be no, and it makes it harder for the other side to accept democratic outcomes which aren't in their favor. And we saw this at some level in 2016 when Trump won. I think many of us felt that our country was under threat in this very foundational way. Luckily, we got through it and we survived. And we saw an intensification of that in 2020 when many Republicans, unfortunately, were not willing to accept the results when Joe Biden won. The question is, can we keep on doing this every 4 years where each party sees the other as, in some sense, illegitimate? Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way to lower the stakes and to also acknowledge that life is elsewhere. Politics isn't everything. And that there have to be other pursuits and other things that we value above politics. And that can help us have some degree of modesty and humility about politics in this world, that right. There are no final victories. And I think one thing that religion at its best offers is a kind of postponement of judgment, that final judgments don't have to happen here and now, because that is obviously very intense, but can actually come, you know, in the next life, if you believe in that. And if you don't believe in the next life, then presumably this wouldn't come at all. And you could still find a way to postpone this and say that not everything has to be focused on this particular mm-hmm. moment mm-hmm. because we are fallible. We don't always know what's right in the moment. And to be able to acknowledge being wrong about big political questions is something I think both parties have to become better at doing. But right. I don't know if we're moving in that direction. I think we're moving in the opposite direction.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Shadi Hamid, hang on here for just a second because I want to bring Joseph Bottom into the conversation. He joins us from Black Hills, South Dakota. He's a professor of philosophy and director of the Classics Institute at Dakota State University, author of many books, including An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic, and The Spirit of America. Joseph Bottom, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
How are you seeing a rise in religiosity in American politics? Where are you seeing it?
Well, of course, it's everywhere. It's on the left. It's on the right. It's been going on for many years. I'm a little troubled by religiosity in this context, okay. That word, as a kind of generic word, because it seems to me, taking the kind of step back that Shadi Hamid advises us to do, is exactly right. But it needs to be a step back in American history. We need to look at the shape of this kind of thing. When you played those clips from Kelsey Obeywe, mm-hmm. They were extraordinary. And, you know, you correctly identified the very churchy kind of non-church going that he's practicing and that he's going to politics for. But I think we also want to say it's in a very American kind of non-church going. And in particular, it takes its cues of behavior and attitude and moral outrage and sense of self from the defining kind of American religiosity, which was Protestantism.
Okay.
This is not generic Christian belief. This is not how Catholics in Italy fall away from the church. This is how Americans, as heirs of the social gospel movement, as heirs of these clashing mainline churches, mainline is a word from the 1950s, but we can kind of import it right back to think of these sort of mainstream of American Protestantism, magisterial churches, and they gave a shape to the country. This was the Mississippi that rolled through American history.
Well, Joseph Bottom, stand by for just a second, because we're 20 seconds off from a break. I want to hear much more about this when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking about the fact that the Gallup organization has found that now, for the first time, fewer than half of Americans say they belong to a house of worship. And we're wondering where that need for community, for moral grounding, has gone, and if it's gone in part into or further into American politics. I'm joined today by Shadi Hamid. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a contributing writer for The Atlantic, recently wrote an article about this for The Atlantic. Joseph Bottom joins us as well. He's a professor of philosophy at Dakota State University and author of An Anxious Age. And Professor Bottom, before the break, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there, but you were talking about a particular American kind of church going and why understanding that's important to this conversation. Continue, please. You know,
Tocqueville speaks of the rival denominations and how they disagreed with one another. The Lutherans disagreed with the Methodists and the Methodists disagreed with the Congregationalists. But these were all Protestant sects, Protestant denominations, and he says they combined, despite their theological disagreements, they combined to provide what he called the central current of American morals and manners. And this central current lasted for a long time. In 1965, just over 50% of Americans belonged to one of seven Protestant denominations. And this is what we meant by the main line. These are the churches you see as you drive down the leafy streets of small city America. It's the Methodist Church and the United Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ and the Episcopalians. And this was very American when the National Council of Churches, which united them, built its office building in New York, the God Box up on Riverside Drive, President Eisenhower flew up to lay the cornerstone of the building because this was America. This was the central theme of America, American experience, a very American institution. Today, the numbers who belong to those seven denominations is under 10%. That is a huge sociological shift. And what the collapse of the churches did is produced the strange 1990s, for instance, that Shadi and Casper spoke of.
Right.
Because with the dropping out of the mainline churches that gave this blue blood American tone to our institutions, the two largest Christian groups that had always been on the outside, the evangelicals on one side and the Catholics on the other, were sort of sucked into the vacuum and met for the first time. Most evangelical Bible church members had never even met a Catholic. And suddenly they were on the same side. Eventually they came to be on the same side on the abortion debate, for instance. And this made American politics very strange. But one way to perceive it is everyone is struggling to position themselves as the new mainline. We saw this in the 80s with feminism. We saw this in the 1990s with the neoconservatives. We're seeing it now with both sides, but especially the Antifa, Black Lives Matter left that wants to say that they are the moral center of the nation. They give the tone to everything else. The way I put it, which is echoed by both your other guests, is when you think your ordinary political opponents are not merely mistaken but actually evil, you have ceased to do politics and begun to do religion.
Yeah. Well, I would argue that that exact belief is also evident on the right in terms of, again, I keep coming back to the fervor with which people threw themselves behind or at the feet, if I can use that metaphor, of Donald Trump. I mean, the language of evil was very much used on the right as well. And what I'm curious to know, Joseph Bottom, I come back to a question that I asked to Shadi Hamid a few minutes ago, and I'd love to hear your answer to it. And that is, if for the sake of argument, we could say, presume for a moment that before the collapse of the Protestant mainline churches, as you were saying, in terms of membership, that was a place for people's belief, value, moral groundings to have a home. But if that home is now seen as American politics, to me, the big difference is that politics and then its enacting vehicle of policy has an impact way beyond people who have those same beliefs, right? It's actually a way to have an impact on everyone in this country, regardless of their beliefs. And that's troubling to me.
Well, Meghna, there you put your finger on exactly the danger. When the churches contained demons, they corralled them and barricaded them off. Your anxieties about salvation. And I do want to talk about that because I think spiritual anxiety is an underutilized sociological tool that Max Weber gave us. And we need to resurrect it to look at America today and to understand it. But you put your finger exactly on the problem. When you have fundamental disagreements in church, you can exclude, you can banish, you can shun, you can try for heresy. You can do all kinds of things that churches have had thousands of years of experience putting together their response to. But when those ideas escape the churches and they enter politics and they enter our workplace, suddenly you don't have the distinction between the religious space and the secular space. So how can you work with someone who thinks Trump was a great guy? You know, it may seem ridiculous that you would think that, but how can you work with someone like that? Because that person is evil. And in the church, that question made sense. How can you worship with someone who actually is a secret follower of Satan? There's an obvious and easy answer to that. But the workplace was supposed to be secular. Mm-hmm. It's where we could keep our religious ideas out of it because we had a place to put them in our churches. Now they've escaped. And what do you do in your, as Casper mentioned, your exercise group? Mm-hmm. There was a wonderful little knitting group on Instagram a couple years ago that blew up over political questions. And we tend to find this pressure on both the left and right, as you said, to politicize everything. And the pressure comes from the religious fervor of those right. political ideas.
Well, let me let Shadi Hamid bring him back in here into the conversation. Shadi, your response to what Joseph Bottom's saying.
Yeah, I think that. So the question is why? It's a question about human nature, that do we naturally incline towards having religious fervor, and that it has to be, if it's not directed in one place, it will be transferred to another. And I think that there was this sense through the latter half of the 20th century that we could move beyond those fervors and enjoy life, focus on leisure, just look inwards. And I think that there was a fundamental mistake and assumption there that some of these passions that I would argue are inherent to the human condition can in fact be displaced. And I think what we're seeing is their reemergence in any number of ways. I mean, that is still somewhat contested, but I think we're seeing more and more evidence of this. And it's not just in the US context, but also with the rise of far-right Hindu nationalists in India, mm-hmm. the religious right in Israel, Bolsonaro in Brazil, the list goes on. So, and I would say too that we are, Americans have been a nation of believers, and I mean that in a broader sense, that we do have a history of fervor really from the beginning.
Yes.
That where maybe you could say in certain Western European countries, again, you can sort of fall back on a common sense of ethnicity. These are still relatively homogenous countries, at least compared to the racial diversity that we see in the U.S. But we can't fall back, and it's good that we can't fall back on a shared ethnicity. That wouldn't be a good option. And I think that there are many on the right who are trying to do that, and that's dangerous. So in that sense, it's a uniquely American predicament of what to do with all this excess fervor and belief,
right,
and passion.
Well, so I want to offer this thought. I was talking about today's show with our news analyst, the ever brilliant Jack Beatty, yesterday, and he pointed me to Richard Hofstadter in the paranoid style of American politics. I know both of you know it really well. And Jack pointed me to this particular quote where Hofstadter writes, "Political life is not simply the arena in which conflicting interests or of various social groups in concrete material gains are fought out. It is also an arena in which status aspirations and frustrations are projected." And Jack suggested that we've always had this mix of interest-based politics, you know, material aims and goals, to put it simply, and status-based politics. But now we're very strongly tipping over into status-based politics or identity-based politics being the predominant animating force here. And he pointed out, here's one measurable way in which that's having an impact on the entire country. There was a recent poll of Republican voters, and they were asked, what should the goals of government be? And only 25% of the respondents said it should be enacting good public policies. 50% of them said the goal of government should be ensuring the country's, quote, survival as we know it. Now, Joseph Bottom, I don't know how that approach is tenable or sustainable in what's supposed to be a secular democracy.
Well, we would have to drill down in that data a little bit because those people concerned about foreign policy could well answer that question that way without being prone to this kind of religiosity we're describing. Mm-hmm. So I'd want to get a little more information before I took that poll at face value.
Sure.
But I know what you mean, right? Our politics is rife with all this religious anxiety. And like all anxieties in a social context, it matches up with social anxieties and questions of class. Mm-hmm. The thing about those blue-blooded Protestants who set the tone for America, at least through the 1950s, is they were overtaken by enthusiasm, by enthusiastic movements and frenzy at various times. And some of that was good. Abolition came out of this. Some of it was less good. Prohibition came out of one of these frenzies. But all of it, you know, was this very American kind of rise of religiosity – and religious enthusiasm, and then falling back into a calmer kind of approach to the world. Now, our hope is, of course, that the religious fervor that we feel now on both the left and the right, and even internationally to some degree, also on the left. I mean, what we see in Venezuela has some of these tones, but it's on the left. But still, you know, in America, it has a shape. We've seen it before. We've seen the precise shape before in The Surprising Works of God, that description of the First Great Awakening from Jonathan Edwards. He actually points out that it began among the young people. And he was surprised by their turn. And if we read it in a certain way, we discover that the older people felt ashamed. They couldn't stand up to the fervor of the young people. And so they got caught up in the movement themselves. I think in a lot of ways, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a kind of great awakening, but it is, in Flannery O'Connor's wonderful phrase from Wise Blood, it is the Church of Christ without Christ.
Uh-huh. Well, we just have 2 minutes left, and I want to give both of you a chance to have one last word here. But Shadi Hamid, it sounds like Joseph Bottom, in taking the long view of American history, sees these moments of sort of religious fire in American politics as dying down of their own accord over time. Do you share that same view?
Yes, I think one key part of this, too, is that, you know, as Joseph alluded to, there was a time when the main Protestant denominations were kind of broad-based. So it wasn't the province of one party. So the other issue here is that once you have outward observant Christian, white Christians, I should emphasize, concentrated in one party, and then the other party, the Democrats here, are becoming thoroughly secularized, that's another layer that creates this sense that your party affiliation affects how you view religion.
Right.
But this is all to say, like, when you look at all these factors, it's hard for me to see how this is reversed, because once you have a thorough secularization, it is difficult to undo those effects. I mean, what we've seen in Western Europe is that it just kept on going down, and it was never able to recover. There was no backlash. There was no reawakening or rediscovery. And I guess the concern is, short of an act of God, what will make more Americans more Christian? One idea was the pandemic, that people would return to faith. It doesn't seem to have worked out that way.
Right. Joseph Bottom, I wish we had another hour or two to talk, but we only have 30 seconds. Do you have a final thought on this fascinating issue?
I think we need, as I said, to understand the concept of spiritual anxiety as a sociological tool to understand what's going on. And if we look at our anxieties, we will see their religiosity, their social class, and their politics all combining in ways that make this moment a fascinating one in American history.
Well, Joseph Bottom is a professor of philosophy and director of the Classics Institute at Dakota State University, author of An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Shadi Hamid, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and contributing writer for The Atlantic. It was great to have you, Shadi. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.